This is
KUT.
KUT, Austin.
Stop. I used to get mad at my school. The teachers that taught me went cool. They're holding me down, turning me around, filling me up with your room. I have to admit, it's getting better, a little better, all the time. Hello, and welcome to Higher Ed, KUT's podcast focusing on issues of higher education, lifelong learning, and exercising the brain. I'm Jennifer Staton with KUT 90.5, Austin's NPR station, talking as always with Dr. Ed Berger, president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. Hello, Ed.
Hello, Jennifer, and how are you?
Well, I'm doing very well. Thanks for asking.
You seem to be in good spirits.
I am in good spirits. Well, I always change. Excuse me?
Well, you know,
I was in good spirits until that little
I always worry
comment.
That I bring you down when I come to visit you.
No, I enjoy our conversations very much.
Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this one, and I'm especially looking forward to this particular topic.
Why is that?
Well, I just think it's one that, you know, it has roots or a rich discussion in academia, but really applies in lots of different places in our lives.
Oh,
but
okay.
I want to start with a question for you.
Please.
I'm curious, if you can think back to your time, any of your time in formal education in school.
As a student?
As a student,
okay.
Yes.
Yes.
Did you participate in class a lot? Did you raise your hand, answer questions, or were you? Because you've said to me that before that you consider yourself shy.
Yes.
Which I find shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Did you like raise your hand and talk in class a lot, or were you more reserved?
Yeah, I was reserved to the nth degree.
Really?
Now, I always sat in front because my eyes aren't so good and I really wanted to be kind of in in the moment. But I never wanted to speak, ever, no matter what the subject was.
Even math?
Even math. So if it was in my comfort zone, I didn't want to speak. And if I was out of my comfort zone, I definitely didn't want to speak. So if I was forced to speak, if the teacher cold called and said, Ed, you know, what do you think? I mean, I would answer. I wouldn't, you know, freeze up. But I hated it. I took a class once as a graduate student here in Austin, and it was taught in an inquiry-based approach, which means that basically they give you a list of things to do in math, their theorems, and then you have to figure out the proofs of the theorems on your own. And I remember that very first day, the professor passed these things out, and I was so nervous because I didn't want to be picked. This is my, you know, early on. First semester of graduate school. And I felt really dumb. Everyone feels really dumb when they first start, you know. And the next class day, I was picked to do the very first one. And from that point on, I physically got sick before every single one of this class. I mean, not in a bad way, but my stomach got upset because I was so nervous. And I was a semi-adult, right? It was after college. That's how bad it was.
So why do you think it felt so scary and challenging to speak up? Especially by the time you got to your area of expertise and you were in graduate school, because my sense is that you are not alone in that regard. I know there are people of all ages at all stages of formal education who are nervous to speak in class even...
Or speak in public.
Right, or speak in public at all, even if they're confident in the information that they're going to share.
That's right. I mean, for me at the time, it was being very self-conscious, feeling that it was a very large class. There was an incoming class. This was back in the mid-1980s when a lot of schools were taking a lot of math graduate students because we needed a lot of math people at the time. And they were all smarter than I was. A lot of them already had masters, and I was intimidated. So it was intimidation, it was self-consciousness, and it was insecurity. I mean, for me, those are the three big ones. And over time, I mean, I'm probably still insecure and I'm still self-conscious, but I'm just so old that I just don't care anymore. And so that's why I can talk to you today. And also, I've been doing it for so long in terms of just speaking in general that it no longer bothers me, and I enjoy it. But I am shy, and I think a lot of people feel that way. And so the question is, do they have the opportunity to overcome it as I've had those wonderful opportunities? Or if not, then it kind of sits with you longer, and then it becomes a thing.
How would you describe the role that each party can play in getting past that? And by each party, I mean thinking of a classroom, both a teacher and the student.
Yes.
You mentioned cold calling of a professor or a teacher just saying, you over there, answer this, you over there.
Right.
Is that a good strategy?
I don't think there's any good or bad strategies. I will say that
effective strategy.
Well, and I think there's no effective yes or no strategy. It depends on the instructor. And for me, when I'm in the classroom, I do like cold calling because I want people, I know how I want them to feel. So some instructors might want people to feel very comfortable and very safe and so forth. I want them to be on their toes and never to know what's going to come next. So they have to be ready and just boom, 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 kind of really sharp like that. So I do like cold calling, but it does, I'm not suggesting or recommending that everyone does that because it might not be in the teacher's style. Conversely, you're talking about, you know, you're asking about me and I'm sharing that I never wanted to speak in class. It's interesting to look at the opposite side, by the way.
The people who, the students who are always answering and speaking.
And I want to tell you that a few times that can be to the point of a disruption. And I'll tell you that a couple of times I had a deal with this where I had two separate classes. I had two different students who were so enthusiastic about the mathematics in the class that and just so attuned to it and so happy that they literally shouted out the answer to every single question I asked, which really was demoralizing to the rest of the class. It, first of all, it made them feel like there's no point in them being there. And then they felt kind of not as smart. And, you know, and so it was all negative. And so what do you do then?
Here's someone who's... what did you do?
Right, the person's enthusiastic. Yeah. You don't want to squelch that. So here's what I came up with. Tell me what you think. In fact, you can assess this.
Okay.
It worked well, I will tell you. So I think this was kind of a good idea. I finally pulled... So in each case, I finally pulled the individual out and said at the end of class, oh, I need to see you. And so I pulled this person out and I said, I just love that you are so connected with this class, and it is so great, and you seem to be, you are conjoined with the material, you understand everything, and I love that you're in it in the moment, and it's live, and it's great, and I love it. So, I'm going to bring you on the inside.
Interesting.
You're now going to come on the inside. You're no longer now just a regular student. I'm going to let you in, you know, kind of behind the scenes. And so the person's like, oh, wow. You know, the person's thinking, wow, now I'm made it to the next level. Like it's like a game, right? I made it to the next level of the game. And I said, so here's what we're going to do. If I ever ask a question, I'm just going to know that you know the answer. So don't even bother to raise your hand.
Oh.
This is going to be a little telepathic thing going on between
Interesting.
Us. You follow me? And I'm going to see if I can get someone else to talk. And if I can't or if I just want to, I can always come to you and I'm just going to call on you. And I know and you know that you're going to have something to say. How about that? And the person goes, oh, wow, thank you. Yes. And it actually worked both times.
Yeah.
They just shut up. And so it allowed the other students in the class to thrive, find their voices, engage. And I, by the way, engaged each of these people in these two different classes because they were great, right? I mean, and I wanted to encourage that, but I didn't want to squelch them. So this was a way of squelching them without squelching them. What do you think?
Well, it sounds like it did work very well.
Worked,
and that sort of insider track is kind of a way to do that. Because you're right, you don't want to shut them down while you're trying to get them to be a little less participatory.
In the heat of the moment, what I want to say is, will you just stop it and shut up for gosh sakes and let someone else have a turn? But you don't want to say that. And so I thought, let's bring you on the inside. And they loved it. And by the way, in both cases, those people are now mathematics professors at schools.
Oh, really?
Yes. So they really were. They did love math. It was legal. It was legit.
They loved it. And your technique did not deter them from pursuing.
Yes. I am not. You can't blame it on me. They kept going.
Pursuing anything in math. That's so interesting. Sort of that counterpoint about students who are frequent contributors.
Yeah. Which to me can be just as disruptive as when you ask a question. Suppose you don't want a cold call. And so you ask a question and no one raises their hand. By the way, I heard there's an elementary school teacher somewhere out there in the United States that tells her students that when I ask a question, every hand goes up. And if you raise your right hand, it means that you don't know the answer. And if you raise your left hand, it means that you either know the answer or want to be picked. And so that way, if someone were to observe her class, like someone observing her, every time they ask a question, boom, all the hands go up. And you think it might be a little bit unethical, but the ethics of it as she kind of articulated it, which I think is really interesting, is it forces them to hear questions. And then to make an assessment whether they want to answer or not. So everyone's engaged. Even if you don't want to answer, you're doing something. And I kind of like that. It's like, you know, online voting where everyone has a little clicker. And I love the idea that everyone is doing something. I just think it's kind of cool.
All right. Well, it's time for us to do something now.
Uh-oh,
it's time
that?
For a new puzzler.
Ooh. Would you like a new puzzler?
Yeah.
Okay.
Why
well,
not?
I'm not going to give you a new puzzler. I'm going to give you a very fun, old riddle.
Riddle. Oh, good. I love these. Okay.
Now, I want to say in full disclosure, not just to you, Jennifer, but to our wonderful, brilliant, and loyal listening audience, that many times I have come on our program and offered you something where I have showed off a little bit and said, I figured this out, or I did it real quickly, or I did it instantly, and then I love to watch you struggle a little bit, although sometimes you figure it out faster than I do. Let me tell you in full disclosure that this puzzle, which I read somewhere,
okay,
I could not figure out.
Interesting.
And
okay.
I had to cheat, and I had to look at the answer. And so I share that with you to let you know that I don't always get them right.
Okay.
You will be able to figure this out. Our listeners will figure it out because you're far more brilliant than I, but I could not do it. Are you ready for this?
Well, I'm ready now after
that
buildup.
Here is the riddle.
Okay.
A sundial
is
a timepiece that has the fewest number of moving parts. Right. It's only one thing.
Right. Okay. Got it.
And nothing moves.
Got it. Right.
Which timepiece has the most moving parts? So the sundial has the fewest moving parts, zero, nothing moves. Which timepiece has the most moving parts? That's the riddle.
Which timepiece has the most moving parts?
Can I tell you my initial thought since I didn't get this right?
Because I had a quick thought that popped into my head.
I was thinking of like Big Ben, you know, or something like, you know, really ornate structure with lots of things moving and so forth. And so I was thinking kind of that way. Boy, was that bad.
No, it's not bad. It's just a different way to think about it.
Yes.
So.
Correct. Thank you.
This is really interesting.
Isn't that fun?
Yeah, very
fun. I could not figure this out. You will.
And well, I had kind of a quick initial thought. Now I'm kind of mulling over.
Mm.
I'm hung up. I'll tell you where I'm hung up. I'm hung up on exactly what constitutes a timepiece.
Mm. Well, okay.
Well, when we talk about the next episode, I'll tell you what
you
want
to write down your answer just so I can tell the audience if you're.
Well, so it depends sort of. I mean, these were the first two things I thought of. So if you're thinking about like what helps in the creation of the sense of time.
Mm. I think you should say those things. Okay. I suggest you say it right now live. It's okay.
Well, okay. So the things I thought of.
I think it's brilliant.
Because sundial, I'm thinking of, so what else contributes to that creating the effect of being able to tell time? So the sun. Mm-hmm. So if that's in fact a timepiece, I said that. But then I also said, but then if you think about time as like the rotation of the earth and then I said the earth.
So earth and sun.
Right.
And even if you put them together, that would just be two moving pieces. And certainly Big Ben has more than two moving pieces.
Well, I was thinking of like the earth as a unit sort of timepiece itself and all the things on earth that are moving.
Oh, they're moving.
And then I'm like, they're like 40 billion.
All right.
Things.
Well, in that case, you would win if that's your thing. All right.
Right. Not as a unit together. Because you're right. That would only be two.
Right. Right. Okay. But it's an interesting question. I like how you're thinking about this, by the way.
Well, we have come at it at totally different, completely different angles. I can't wait to hear the answer now.
You're going to be really mad.
I'm like, okay. Well, all right.
Because I was mad.
We're talking
because
about.
I didn't think about it.
Well, we're talking about speaking up. So I will speak up next week and
tell
let
me
you
if
know.
You're mad.
And I will let you know
okay,
if I am
you.
Mad. Just as we wrap up our discussion about speaking up, you know, if you had a student come into your office and say, you know, Dr. Berger, I'm in, pick any class, a math class, English class, and I have things to say, and I think I have some right answers. Sometimes I want to contribute, but I'm just so nervous and scared to raise my hand or to speak up. Everybody else in the class seems so much smarter. What would you say to that student of any stage, you know, kindergarten, graduate school?
Sure.
How would you help them kind of start to get over that hump?
Well, the first thing I would suggest is to talk to the instructor, professor, teacher. Assuming now that I am the teacher of record, then I would say, you know, would you be willing to share with me, you know, if you're comfortable, why is it that you don't want to speak up? And then I would ask it not in a defensive way, but am I creating an environment where you don't want to speak? Am I going too fast, for example, or am I going too slow? Or, you know, what is it about it? Or is it the fact that you're shy? Or, you know, where is it coming from? And I'd have that person just speak. Now, they might identify the real hidden reason, or they might be identifying the symptoms that are actually causing the real reason. But the important thing is to engage that student in a dialogue, in a conversation. That's why education really is individualized. And to try to make that person feel comfortable in sharing. The next thing I would do is say, would you like me to call on you? So I would now remember, I typically cold call, but let's assume that I wouldn't. Then I would actually say, would you like me to call on you or would you like me to not? And maybe we could have, almost like with that other student, have like a little signal if you're comfortable or not. So that's the next thing I would say. And then if they would say, no, I really prefer you don't call on me, then I think what I would do, and again, I'm just improvising here, I'd say, okay, great. But then I'd like for you to come to office hours on a semi-regular basis, not every office hour, but on a kind of regular basis, and I want you to share with me some of the thoughts that you aren't comfortable sharing in class. So at least we can have a conversation and I can respond to them and be excited by them or, you know, challenge you with something else, and so we can keep that process going. So that's what I would do. I will say that, as you might remember, in all my classes now, I have official questioners, which is the opposite. So to get people engaged, even the shy ones, they are randomly picked out. I've got all their names on index cards. I pick out a couple, and I say, Jennifer, you're an official questioner. So your job before the end of the class is not to answer a question, but to ask one. And that puts you in a different position. So if you're shy, okay, you're still shy, but you're not going to be vested in putting yourself out there to say an answer that might be wrong. You have to ask a question, which, as we discussed, I would argue is actually harder and more creative, but at least it's not a right or wrong thing.
Right.
And so that's another thing I do to get people to speak up in class.
Well, Dr. Edberger, we are always glad that you speak up.
Thank you.
Dr. Edberger is president of Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. You can find out more at southwestern.edu. And you can keep your brain busy by keeping up with the news and other episodes of Higher Ed at KUT.org. You can also find us on iTunes and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jennifer Staton, KUT News.